From the studios of Radio Sai at Prashanti Nilayam, I am Chandu Vijay and this is Love to Love. And today we have a talk by Mr. John Boehner. John first visited Swami in 1979 and has been a part of the Sai organization for about 30 years. And from 1995, he was a zone chairman for Latin America. And more recently, zone chairman for Central America and part of the Caribbean. John has also been the president of the Sai Foundation of El Salvador since its inception in 1989 and has been administering for the relief efforts of the Sathya Sai World Foundation since 2010. In addition to that, Swami has also blessed John to chair the Christmas program for the last several years. The topic of his talk is self-realization, and this talk was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashanti Nilayam on the 10th of August 2016. Stay tuned, dear listeners. Interspersed and after the talk, we have some soulful songs by Miss Dana Gillespie. And at 3:30 p.m. we will have the live Telugu segment Sri Sathya Sai Divya Sandesha Jhari. And with that, over to John Boehner.
I offer my love and my pranams at Bhagavan's lotus feet. Welcome to all of you. Today, I'd like to talk about liberation and the fact that it's something that we can all experience in this very lifetime. I know all of you are involved in this seriously or you wouldn't be here. And it's something that has fascinated me and my family ever since we discovered Swami, or he discovered us. In one of our first interviews, we had come with my son and my daughter. The first time we came, I think my son was 14 years old and my daughter was 17. And so this was a couple of years later, I think around 1981, when this happened. And so my son was 16 at that time. And so he'd been here a couple of times and he'd been reading some books. So when Swami asked him, he says, "What do you want?" in an interview, and his name is Eric. And so Eric said to Swami, he said, "Oh, Swami, I want liberation." And so Swami said, "Well, what's liberation?" And Eric said, "Well, liberation is union with God." And excuse me, he said, "No, liberation is union with you." And then Swami said, "Well, who am I?" And then Eric said, "Well, you're God." And then Swami said, "How do you know?" And so then Eric said, "Well, how do you explain God?" And Swami said, "You don't explain God, you experience God." Now you see how this is something that we're all trying to do. We're all trying to experience God, each one of us. And it's true, many of us have had this, we've experienced God, we've experienced Swami, but in his physical form. But then how do we experience his non-physical form? And so then Swami asked, or said to Eric, he said, "The difference is between you and me," he said, "you think that God is something outside of you. That there's a difference between you and God." And he said, "But I know that I am God." He says, "That's the difference between." He says, "God is like the water with a fish swimming through the water. And so God is in you, above you, below you, around you. He's everywhere, in everything." And So then, if this is the situation, this is what we're looking for, to have this experience, to be able to be the fish and to feel God all around us, how do we get there? And obviously it's not such an easy process, or we'd all be, you know, walking around as liberated souls, as jivan muktas. So I'd like to start by reading something, because Swami gave a talk, or gave a divine discourse, once, in which, and I was there and I remember, but I haven't been able to find the reference, but he said, starting around 2012 to 2017 or so, 5 or 6 years, he said, there's going to be a window that opens that will help all of us to discover our true reality. Now, I remember Swami saying this, but I still haven't found the reference. But I did find a reference, and this is from the Mayan Indians. And this is very interesting, because it's the same type of thing, but they're explaining why. And I'm going to read it, because it's a little technical. And so then I asked the question, what did Swami mean when he referred to a period of 4 to 6 years from 2012, when it would be easy to raise our consciousness and become aware of our divine nature? The Mayan 5,200-year cycle is when the solar elliptic plane comes into alignment with the galactic plane. In other words, the solar elliptic plane comes into alignment with the galactic plane. This makes it possible for more intense cosmic energy to reach the Earth from the galactic core. There is then a corresponding increase or decrease in the level of human consciousness, i.e., parts of the brain either go online or offline. Anybody a computer expert here? According to the Mayan calendar, 2012 corresponds to the end of the current Mayan cycle and will lead to a rapid transformation of global consciousness. This is Swami's golden age come true, of increased human potential, of love and peace on earth, which Premasai will come to usher in. Now, when I found this, say, prophecy of the Mayans or explanation from the Mayans, it dovetails perfectly with what Swami said. So, it's clear that we're getting, at this moment, we're getting a boost, as it were, from cosmic energy, which is obviously manipulated by God also, and makes it possible for us to have this leap forward in consciousness. But again, it's still not so easy. It isn't something that just because this cosmic energy is reaching us, all of a sudden we're going to become jivan muktas. No. This has been a process, I think, for all of us. And in my case, it started with service. Because when I first came here and had one of my first experiences with Swami, he was distributing food for all the people that were in the auditorium. We were in Whitefield, and it was Christmas time. And Swami was giving a plate of food to every single person in the auditorium. Well, naturally, when you got your plate of food from Swami, you said, oh, thank you, Swami. And when I got my plate, he said, it's my duty And then I thought, my God, here I'm in front of somebody who's probably the most outstanding, renowned individual in the world, and he says it's his duty to give me a plate of food. At that time, I was working for a multinational company, and I'd been to meetings with directors in New York, and they'd never given me a plate of food. It was hard to shake hands with them, even. And here I was with somebody so much more important, and he says, but it's my duty. And then I discovered that Swami said, because I didn't know very much about Swami when I came here, but Swami said that his life was his message. So obviously, what he's serving others, that was his message. And then as I learned more about Swami, he said, well, your life is my message too. And so then I thought, uh-oh, that means I got to start serving too. Well, at that time, we live in El Salvador in Central America, and it's a place, it's a country that has beautiful beaches. And the beaches are very close to the city, about 45 minutes. And we had a house at the beach, and I mean right on the beach, right in front of the water. And we also had a swimming pool, and every weekend we were down with the family, with friends, and the beach was sort of our, you could say it was our God, because we were always there. And the water is warm all year round. You can swim in the water. It's like your bathtub. And, you know, it's a really a wonderful, beautiful place. And so then I was thinking, but after I met Swami and he said, your life is my message too. Then I thought, well, we better do some service. But how can we do service if we got this house at the beach and we're going there every weekend? So my wife had come back to India almost immediately, and so I thought, well, I'll take advantage while she's gone and I'll sell the house at the beach. And so I sold it, and so then when she came back, of course, she was upset, and a little volcanic eruption. And she said, we could have sung bhajans there. But the truth was that we wouldn't have sung bhajans. But at least it freed up my time, because I was working, and our time, let's say, on the weekends to do service. And so this doing service was part of a sadhana which helped us as individuals to learn to love. Now, this might sound strange when you say learn to love, but when you're someone like I was, a materialist that thought that the most important thing in the world was to provide for your family and have a nice home and have good education for the kids and that then make enough money to retire and have a good retirement, then you're living a completely sheltered life, not thinking about others and just thinking about getting ahead. So when I started going to hospitals and orphanages and old people's homes and meeting these people and then getting to know them, not just going there and saying hello or something on a weekend, no, but going back every weekend and meeting these people and the same people and getting to know them. Then my heart started opening to these people because many of them, there was nothing they could give in exchange for the time and the what we were doing for them, bathing them, shaving them, cleaning, and other things. And so, and I remember I had many experiences that were, that opened my heart. There was a boy who, he couldn't walk. He'd had polio, I guess, when he was little. And he was on the floor. But he was a boy about 20 or 21 years old. And so I was able to get a wheelchair for this boy. And I never will forget the expression on his face when we put him in the wheelchair, and he, with his hands, he made the wheelchair go as fast as he could, and when he got to a wall, he put his feet up against the wall to catch himself, and then pushed off and went backwards, and he was just, he was ecstatic. He had legs. He'd been on the floor his whole life, and now all of a sudden he had legs. And very quickly he learned to manage this wheelchair and do all kinds of acrobatics in it and everything else, but he was just ecstatic. Or sometimes, like a person an old person that couldn't see, and to give them glasses, you've given them their eyes back. Things like this. There was an old lady that used to, she lived in a shack, and she lived by begging in the marketplace. And I was, at that time I started teaching a class of Balbikas. And so I would take the children over there to this little shack that was pretty close to where the Sai Center was. And we'd meet with this old lady. And it was really a shack. I mean, she was a collector. She had the thing was, her little shack was full of newspapers and empty bottles and plastic containers. And I mean, it was a mess. But we got the idea we were going to plant a vine, which we planted chow chow, which grows on a vine. And we put in a couple of plants on either side, and then it could grow over the roof, the tin roof that she had. And then she could sell these chow chows in the market instead of asking for people for money. Well, these vines, they took off like they were. It was amazing. I mean, you've never seen such beautiful vines that grew so fast and prospered and were just full of chow chow. And so this old lady, she had an income then. She could sell these in the marketplace. But, I mean, doing these things, it just opened up my heart. And it made me, you know, you think about these people during the week and how could you help them and what else could you do for them and like that. And then all of a sudden I wasn't living just for money or for my family, or it started helping me to see that there was somebody else in the world that I could do something for. And so this for me was sort of like the first step in my sadhana. But then, of course, as time goes on, we're starting a more disciplined sadhana. And I think we've all done this, each one of us, because Swami would give us, he would give us tips of what to do. And of course, like the light meditation. Now, as I told you, I was teaching a class of Balbikas. And so, we were practicing the light meditation. But, you know what happened? I thought light meditation was for Balbikas. I didn't think it was for me. And I mean, well, I practiced it while I was with the Balbikas, but I didn't practice it every day. And so then, and Swami would tell us, he'd say, well, you know, now in this Kali Yuga, the fastest way to God is to repeat the name of God. Just repeat the name, and you're there. That's all you have to do. And so then, of course, I started repeating what was, I thought it was my mantra, because Swami had given me a ring. Well, actually, he gave me two rings, but one had an Om on it, and the other's a Shiva Lingam. And so when he put the Om ring on my finger, he said, Om Namah Shivaya, which then I thought, oh, well, that's my mantra, so I'll always repeat Om Namah Shivaya. And so then you start off and you're going full speed for maybe a week and then 2 weeks, and then you sort of forget, and then you come back to it again, and then it goes away. Has that ever happened to any of you? You know, where you get, you're really enthusiastic and you think, this is the key to it all. And then it's sort of, after a month, you say, well, gee, I don't feel like I'm realized. I don't feel like anything's happening. I wonder, maybe this isn't for me. Maybe there's another one. Ah, the Soham meditation. Soham. And there we go again. Oh, full speed. This is it. But you know, a strange thing happened. One time, my wife and I were in an interview and we asked Swami, how do you die, Swami? Tell us how we should die. And Swami said, oh, well, when you're dying, he said, you repeat the Om. And he even demonstrated, he said, it starts at the navel, the level of the navel, and Om. You move the energy from your navel up to your third eye, and then in a semicircle bring it back down to the navel. Om. And then my wife asked Swami, she said, well, can we use the Soham? And Swami said, oh yes, that's very good. And then he demonstrated that, starting again at the navel, with the energy going up, Soham. Soham. But he said, you've got to practice this all the time, so that when you're dying, that you'll remember this at the last minute and be doing this when you're dying. Well, you know, you get these kind of tips from God, and you say, oh wow, this is, I've got it. But then, I got an appendicitis. And they took me to the super specialties hospital. And, you know, appendicitis is a pretty serious thing. And also, it's very painful, I've got to tell you. And so, the doctors over at the super specialties hospital, they thought maybe they could control it with antibiotics. So they immediately started injecting me with an antibiotic drip. But the Western doctors, they were also coming to visit me every day, and they were saying, oh no, this, you've got to operate immediately. And they would go back and they'd tell Swami, listen, we've got to operate on John right away because this is, now it's peritonitis. It's, the thing is starting to break. And so Swami would always put them off a little bit and say, wait or something. And so they didn't get a go-ahead for my operation. And every day they were putting me through this scanner to find out how much of the thing, how much the infection had spread. And I couldn't sleep. It was the most terrible pain. And my stomach was swelling up like a pregnant woman. And even they got the brilliant idea they were going to measure my stomach every hour to find out if it was swelling up more or if it was going down. It's incredible. And then finally, one day, the U.S. doctors, they went back to see Swami again. They said, we've got to operate on John right away. And then Swami said, oh, but there's an expert coming from the U.S. who's an internologist, who he's the most respected doctor, and let's wait and get an opinion from him. 5 more days before... This was Hari Kanjivaram, who was also in charge here of the medical camps. If you've ever gone to the medical camps, you probably have met Hari. But so Hari comes. And I've been in the hospital now, I think 10 days when Hari got there. And so, and my stomach is swollen up, and I'm 24 hours a day, all I'm thinking is, you know, I didn't think of doing the Om even once. I didn't think of doing the Soham even once, because with so much pain, I was just calling out for Swami. Swami, I thought maybe he would come in his car and give me vibhuti or do something. I mean, it was just terrible. And then Hari comes and he examines me and he looks at the radiographias and everything, and he says, oh my God, you've got to operate now. And he goes running back over to Swami and goes in with the U.S. doctors too. And it's, Swami, we've got to operate on John right now. And then Swami's looking at them and he said, what do you know? I'm doing everything. Oh my God. These doctors, they had their mouths were wide open. They couldn't believe it. I mean, here's a case of peritonitis. The guy's half dead. And Swami's saying, what do you know? So then Hari came back over to the hospital. And so in his car, he took me back over here to the ashram. And my stomach was still bloated up. And so then, you know, an amazing thing happened because a friend of mine was here who has a machine that it's a new, fairly new thing, and it identifies the bacteria, and then it sends a vibration through the body that eliminates the bacteria. So I went on this machine, and in 4 half-hour sessions, I didn't have anything. I was perfect. There was a world conference going on. I went to the world conference like nothing. And so then I showed the results to the Western doctors, and I said, you know, I'd like to get a couple of these machines for the super specialist hospital so the boys can learn, you know, this technique. And no, this is too controversial. No, we don't want any of that here. Allopathic medicine is what we've got here. Okay. But, so obviously Swami knew about this friend of mine who was going to be here with this machine and that I would be saved. But that isn't the point. The point of the story is that, you know, we know how to die then. Swami has told us how we're supposed to die, repeat the Om, and so on. But in practice, what really happens? You know, a lot of us, we might be in the hospital, have a lot of tubes in our mouth and our ears and what all, or an excruciating pain, or maybe they've called the ambulance, and we're in the back of the ambulance, leaving our body and coming back into the body, and we hear the ambulance drivers talking about, oh, this guy isn't going to make it. You know, what are we going to remember the Om? You see the problem.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
You could travel the seven seas, from the valleys to mountains so high, but you'll never find a better love than this, for this love will never die. While the moon and the stars still shine, and the sun lights up the sky, that's how long this love will go on and on and on. For this love will never die. This love will never die. Could spend your life looking out, but the answers are within, and the heart and the soul of the matter is love, and from love we all begin. This love that I'm talking about, you could travel the seven seas till the waters have all run. Of eternity. lost and you can't find your way. You can run, but there's nowhere to hide till you're face to face with yourself. And the mirror of love is your guide. Knowing life's just a game you must play. You could travel the seven seas, but the moment your heart starts to cry,
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will now continue with the talk by Mr. John Beener on self-realization. This talk was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashanthi Nilayam on the 10th of August 2016. Stay tuned.
So, then, what else can we do? I mean, you know, Swami has given us a lot of tools. Now, what about the light? Ah, visualize the light, the concentration. He's told us how to meditate. He said, first comes concentration. And then you concentrate on the light. And you only have to look at that light for 11 seconds without moving your eyes, no blinking. And you're going to be in a state of bliss. And you do it for 144 seconds and you're in samadhi. My God, how easy, how beautiful. Concentrate on the light. Now, so, first day, almost made 11 seconds. Second day, wow, yeah, I got to 11 seconds. I feel really good about this. Next day, well, 11 seconds, I barely made it, but the next day, gee, this is harder than I thought it was going to be. And the next day, and the next day, and then, well, you know, maybe this technique isn't for me. Maybe it's for, you know, these guys that live in the Himalayas or some damn thing, but, you know, I don't think I can do this. Too much concentration. So, but, oh, Swami's given some other techniques, though. I mean, you know, it isn't just like, you know, that's the only thing we can do to you know, obviously. And so then we go back and we start revising all these different things that Swami's told us. He says, well, you know, the first thing is that you've got to have a time that you get up every morning and practice. Now, the best hour is between 3 and 5 in the morning. And this is the Brahma Muhurta when everything is quiet and there's no disturbances outside. And so then, every day between 3 and 5, this is your time. And then you get into this state, and then what do you do when you're in there? Well, I mean, posture is very important, your posture. And keep your hands with the thumb over the forefinger, and keep your spinal column as straight as possible. And then practice the concentration and then the contemplation, and then you'll have meditation. And so, this works real good until there's a party or something, or you have to go out to dinner with some people and you get back at 12 o'clock at night. And how are you going to get up at 3 in the morning? And well, you skip a day, and then the next day you pick up that rhythm again. And so then, you know, we get off the track somehow. But then there's another thing, and this is something that Swami has told us over and over again. And he says, you know, your mind depends on what you eat. And that's why he tells us not to eat meat. I remember before I was a vegetarian, I had a frozen food distribution company, and I used to sell all kinds of meat products. And then after I sold the company, I became a vegetarian. This was even before I knew Swami. And almost immediately, I noted that I didn't have any fear. The fear left me. And the other thing, of course, you feel much more peace, inner peace, being a vegetarian. So these were things that I discovered even before knowing Swami. And then Swami tells us also, he said that the food that we eat, first we have the food which is the nutrition for our body, and then we have what is the part that's the fiber that helps us to eliminate that which we're not going to use. And then the part that is the food for our mind, for our thoughts. Now, here's something that is of vital importance in our sadhana. The food that we eat, if we can keep our diet as close as possible to raw foods, we're going to have our minds much, much better prepared to reach a state of no mind. And the more foods that we consume that are processed foods or that have a little chili or even onions and garlic and things like that that the doctors say are good for us, but that are rahasic, that these are going to perturb our mind and that we're going to have less and less possibilities to reach this state of no mind. So, how did Swami then tell us or guide us in a process where we could discover how to get this liberation? Did he say that, well, here's step one, step two, step three, step four? No, in all his discourses, you won't find a system or something that works for everybody. But in different discourses, he gave us tidbits to practice. And then we needed these tidbits to have, let's say, sufficient desire, and not only the desire, but the determination to reach this goal. And so there's one further point that Swami gave that is very, very important in this process. This other point is the breathing. And Swami talked about akanta bhakti. And many people haven't even heard the term or they haven't found the reference, but this was given the first time that I think that Swami talked about this was that it was in Divine Discourse that Swami gave in 1982 in Madras and Chennai. But in other times also he's spoken of this akanta bhakti. And akanta bhakti is breathing in and out in a rhythmic form in which we breathe in and we breathe out the same length of time without holding our breath. Now, I can remember once I was practicing pranayama, also thinking that I'd gotten onto something that was going to help me with liberation. And so then in an interview I asked Swami, I said, well, am I doing pranayama correctly? And Swami said, what is the purpose of pranayama? And I said, well, Swami, isn't it to help you become liberated? He said, pranayama is to have good health. Uh-oh. So, that wasn't... I think he may have said that also, not because pranayama isn't also a key to becoming liberated, but I think because one needs a teacher, one needs a guru that can supervise. And I think Swami was worried that I might get off on a deep end and something might happen. So he said, oh, it's just for good health. But akanta bhakti is not pranayama. Akanta bhakti is inhalation and exhalation in a rhythmic manner. But when we start, normally we're breathing, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 times a minute. And we know that the animals that breathe slower live longer, and that animals that have rapid breath, such as rabbits or dogs, that they have a shorter lifespan than the elephants and the snakes and the turtles and so on, who are breathing much, much slower than we do too. And so when we start this practice of akanta bhakti, let's try to start by inhaling just a little bit longer than we usually do and exhaling the same amount, but just a little longer than we usually do. And then as we practice, Swami says that we can get to a place where we're inhaling and exhaling once or twice a minute. Now, if we're doing it once a minute, we're inhaling 30 seconds in and 30 seconds out. And if we're exhaling twice, it's 15 seconds in and 15 seconds out, which isn't difficult to get to that point. But we don't start there. And also when we're practicing this, we have to do it slowly. In other words, immediately we're not going to get to 15 seconds in and 15 seconds out. And in the beginning we'll probably be counting the seconds. I know when I was practicing this in the beginning, in my room I have a clock that ticks every second, and I can hear it, tick, tick, tick. And so I would count the ticks, and then I knew how I was doing it. And also, if you lose the rhythm, it doesn't matter. You start over again. Don't give up. Don't say, oh, this doesn't work for me. It will work for you. It'll work for all of us. So this inhaling and exhaling is what Swami says will give the mind complete rest, where we go into a state that we can forget completely about time, space, our body. And it's an amazing feeling to get to that place, because then we are actually, when our mind goes, we're in contact with our reality, with who we really are. And this experience of knowing ourselves, then in my own case, I haven't gotten there yet, but I have had atisbos, or at least experiences when my mind has been completely blank as a result of practicing this akanta bhakti. And for me, it's been the easiest way to get to a state of being able to discover who I really am. Now, I have a friend who's a doctor, and I've known him for many years. He still comes here, but he was living in Venezuela, and now he lives in the U.S. But his name is Dr. Adelio Sanchez. And Adelio had the habit of writing down the symptoms of his patients and also what he prescribed for them. And so when he started trying to put into practice what Swami had taught in terms of how to become a realized soul, he wrote down all of his experiences. And then after that, he wrote a book. Now, this is a very unusual thing because Adelio became a realized soul. He's a Jivan Mukta. And he did it by practicing what Swami said, but very, very intensely. And everything that I've talked about, everything that I've said, he practiced. He put into practice. But everything, not just visualizing the light or concentrating on the light, not just practicing Soham meditation, not just Akanta Bhakti, not just eating raw foods. Adelio practiced everything. And the fact that he's written a book is very, very unusual, because a Jivan Mukta doesn't really have that desire then to share his experience with others. There's been a few people, I think Gopi Krishna and Dr. Goel, some of you may have read their books, but this book by Adelio, and I was going to bring some over to if anybody wanted to get it, but it's in the bookstore. It costs 50 rupees. I brought the Spanish version, but it's in English, and it's called Liberation, a Realizable Goal. I wish I had written the book. I wrote the foreword to the book, but I didn't write the book because I haven't had the experience. But Adelio, the way that he writes it is very interesting, because he writes his experience and then he writes what Swami has said about that experience. So this is, the book is all of these different extracts of divine discourses that give us tips of how to become realized. And then what happened to Adelio when he was practicing this? What was his experience? And he goes on to explain that.
Tune into Sai.
Spend the day with Sai.
From 6 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. on Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Radio Sai Thursday Live.
Stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We will now continue with the talk by Mr. John Beener on self-realization. This talk was delivered in the Satsang Hall here in Prashanthi Nilayam on the 10th of August 2016. Stay tuned.
And then what happened to Adelio when he was practicing this? What was his experience? And he goes on to explain that in the beginning he had, I guess you would call it, a situation where he's in duality. And he starts to feel some motion in his body, even though he's seated completely without movement. And of course, this is another thing that when you're practicing like the Akanta Bhakti, that your body has to be completely still. You can do it sitting in a chair or you can do it sitting on the floor, but your body has to be very, very still and your spinal column as straight as possible. And we're not talking about waking up the Kundalini or anything like that, but that can also be part of it. He explains other experiences that he had, such as hearing the Om when he's in this complete silence, and also seeing a bright light in the third eye, which also I've experienced. And I think many of us in our practices, we've had Swami's given us these little gifts of maybe seconds where we've had these experiences and we've made a contact with our true self, our reality. But we haven't stayed there. And maybe our practices haven't been constant. And so the interesting thing about this book is that Adelio explains that how in a very few short years of practicing intensely everything that Swami said and leading a family life, that he was able to realize his true inner self, his reality. And now he's continued to live in this world and dedicate his life to, well, he still practices medicine. This is, he says there's so many people that need help. But he doesn't practice allopathic medicine. But he has a nature which is so loving that one can understand how when you become a realized soul, that you are just pure love, that you don't see anything else in the world around you but love. And of course, this was what we experienced from Swami himself, that Swami was just pure love. And this pure love was so easy to experience because we didn't have to do anything to receive it. And that Swami would always be looking out for our benefit, for our helping us and doing things for us. And never, never, never would he ask for anything in exchange. And then Adelio also says something else which was very interesting for me. And he said that when you reach this state of pure love, that it's also, you have a tremendous love for God. And you realize this huge gift that God has given to wake you up to your true self, to your true reality. And this is something that we've all got. I mean, we're all part of the divine. Go back right to this interview that my son and I were in, and with my wife and my daughter too. And when Swami said, no, you don't explain God, you experience God. And as we experience God, then this tremendous love is united between our true self. It's a love for oneself, but it's a love also for Swami. Because of there's still duality in this, I guess, where you're thinking of Swami and being grateful, because what is gratefulness? Gratefulness is not only being appreciative, but it is loving that this love that for Swami because of what He's given us. And then as we have this feeling, it expands to everyone. And so we don't consider, we're not looking, nothing is ours, nothing is personal, that we don't see the world the same way anymore. We feel this unity and this oneness. And so this was Adelio's experience, and I'm sorry I didn't bring the right book over. You could have bought some here, but you have to go to the bookstore. It costs 50 rupees. But I really recommend that you read Adelio's book, Liberation. It's the same cover with a picture of Swami. This cover, I don't know if you can see it, but it's called Liberation, A Realizable Goal. And we can all have this experience, but it requires from each one of us determination, dedication, constancy, a really just wanting this more than anything else in the world, sacrificing everything for this. You remember how Swami used to talk about the need to feel like you were somebody that had your head pushed under the water and that you wanted to breathe air, and that's the most important thing, is to get that little breath of air in your lungs. Well, that's how we have to feel in terms of wanting liberation. We're willing to make any sacrifice to have that. Forget making exceptions to the rule about, well, I've got to go out with some friends, and so I'm going to skip my meditation in the morning, or I'm going to a dinner party, so I can't eat my raw foods today. I'll just, you know, take a little rice and dal and skip over the raw food diet, or all these little things that come up in our daily life, that we have to say, no, my goal is liberation. And if this isn't in consonance with my goal, I have to pass it by. I have to skip it. And this is not an easy thing. And also, Swami told me once, he said, to lead a spiritual life in the West is much more difficult than it is to lead a spiritual life in India. And obviously when we're here in the ashram, this place is ideal for foregoing all of these things that are necessary to have this determination to reach a goal. And when we go back home, it's not so easy. It's much more difficult to live in the world and continue to have this discipline of trying to experience our true reality. But Adelio, Dr. Adelio Sanchez, has done this. He would come here for 6 months or a year, and then he would go back to Venezuela, and he explains what he does even during his time, and how he's able to keep his mind through the repetition of the name, repeating the name of God, how he's able to keep focused, even say waiting in line in the bank to cash a check or something, and how keeping the mind concentrated completely on God, even though he's doing something mundane, that he's able to not separate himself from this goal. So let's all remember that we have this grand heritage. Now, I think we'll close with a very short exercise in a Kanta Bhakti. If you'll put your feet on the floor and sit up as straight as possible, and we'll just do a very short exercise. Now, when we breathe deeply, it's like filling a glass with water. And what happens when we fill a glass with water? First of all, the bottom of the glass gets the first part of the water. So in this case, the air going into our body, the first part of our stomach will probably come out just a little bit. Then as we fill the glass, our chest comes out a little bit. And then when we get the glass is almost full, our shoulders might even come up a little bit in deep breathing. And then as we exhale, it's just the reverse of taking the water out of the glass. Shoulders come down, chest comes in, stomach comes in. Now actually, when we're practicing Akanta Bhakti, we won't even be able to perceive our breath. We'll get to the point where you don't feel your shoulders or your chest or your stomach moving. But to begin to practice this deep breathing, it's necessary to be aware that that's the process of expanding the amount of air that we're taking in and then releasing it. So let's close our eyes and put our tongues up against the teeth, the front row of teeth. Close the mouth. And then let's put our thumbs over our index finger, palms facing up, and let's inhale slowly. Let's go up to about eight seconds, and then exhale for 8 seconds. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Inhale. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Exhale. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Inhale. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Exhale. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Inhale. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Exhale. 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I hope that this little practice, we were actually breathing 3 times a minute by inhaling 10 seconds and exhaling 10 seconds. And if you lost the rhythm, you can go back and start over again. Don't give up. And maybe somebody who at one time had been a smoker, maybe it was very difficult to do it this long. Some people have told me what they've had this habit of smoking, and maybe they've given it up 5 or 10 years ago, but they still find it very difficult to say inhale for 10 seconds. But you can still practice for lesser periods of time, and it will give you that same possibility to remove the thoughts from the mind if you are practicing the diet, proper exercise, repeat the name. All these other things are important. We have to have the concentration, then the contemplation, and finally, we will be meditating. And when we're meditating, that's when we're in contact with our true reality. Does anybody have any questions before we close? Yes.
After the liberation, how did he find the difference in the day-to-day life behavior? In the day, the doctor said that he felt liberated. He's a liberated soul now. Now is he finding the day-to-day life?
Yes, and how did the doctor find day-to-day life after he has become realized? And as I tried to explain, he is seeing everybody and everything with so much love that at one moment I was talking to him on the telephone, and he said that he had become so detached from the world that he wasn't really involved in anything except the contemplation of himself. But then about maybe, I don't know, 6 months later, I was talking to him, and he said, you know, I've seen so much need from people that are suffering that I feel I have to come back from this state of bliss and try to help these people that are suffering. And so he has taken it upon himself right now to try to help people and try to help their suffering just out of compassion and love. I think he's going from one state back and forth, but I know he's able to stay in a state of consciousness where he's all the time with his true self. I hope that answers the question. Anyone else?
Sai Ram, at the beginning you have rightly said that God cannot be explained, it can only be experienced. So we cannot explain the experience of that doctor who is liberated. He has to experience, and we have to experience. Our experience, as Swami said, will be the message.
That's a good comment. I think it's time to close now, so with three ohms and three samasta lokas, let's close.
You give me hope when all around was lost, and I could see no point in trying. For I saw love passing by me. You came into my life. You came into my life. I look around and what I had is gone. Now I finally found what I've been missing. The road I travel is so clear. Since you came into my life, you came into my life. Yeah, the star, the shining light, If you hold it near, it'll take you far. Oh, the lamp of love is illumination to see what you really are. Oh, precious one Rupert, embodiment of love, we all belong to the hope and gives us wings to fly to where we all belong, to hear the song the angel sings. Once you hear him call it, it cannot be ignored, for he catches us when we're falling. And he says, am I not your Lord? All to see, it's the only jewel of value, one that sets us free. For worldly pleasures mean nothing compared to the treasures of the heart. And the one who's always giving has made love into a living art. So give your heart completely a promise. that's a promise. Shining on me like